Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everybody. The season finale of Biscuits Colon a Hockey Podcast. It's Tuesday, it's July 31st. And we got some stuff to talk about. I'm Dave Lozo, and I'm in Brooklyn. And you know where Sean is, because Sean is in the heart of hockey. Say hi, Sean.
Hey, everybody. It's me coming from the heart of hockey, Ottawa, Ontario, Canada.
Mm-hmm. The place where all the hockey news comes from.
All the hockey news. You know, we made the decision to stretch this podcast well into July so that we could cover all of the reaction and ramifications of the Erik Karlsson trade and all the other big trades that were going to happen. And here we are.
Yep.
Who wants 40 minutes of Tom Wilson?
Tom Wilson, Cody Ceci, people who think Jerome McGinley is a borderline Hall of Famer for some reason. That one still, I feel like that one just doesn't make any sense. I don't think anybody really thinks that, but we'll get to all that, because we should really start with Tom Wilson, because that's just the funniest story to me. Because
Speaking of borderline Hall of Famers,
speaking of guys who are just one or two more seasons away from just taking the leap into Hall of Fame status, Tom Wilson, oh, I lost it already. Was it 5 years, 5.2, 5.19?
It was 6 years.
6 years.
5.1 and change.
Yeah.
Which is, for a winger, at least today, that is first-line money for Tom Wilson, who did play much of last year on the Washington Capitol first line.
He did. He was a first-liner.
So he is, by definition, a first-line winger, and he gets 6 years. And this is, if you're wondering, if you're just catching up on the news and you're wondering, wait, is this the same Tom Wilson who has scored 35 goals over the course of a five-year NHL career? Yes, it is that guy. Tom Wilson, who last year had 14 goals, 21 assists. So 35 points, career high last year, 14 goals and points. Really doubled his goals, career high. Playing much of the year alongside Alexander Ovechkin and Evgeny Kuznetsov. And he is now a $5 million player for the next 6 years. What are your thoughts, Dave?
Bargain. Total steal. I mean, if you had a chance to lock this guy up, you know, you get a chance to lock up a 14-goal scorer for 6 years, you pay whatever you got to pay. He's a champion, too. You're forgetting this. Like, this is the difference now between Tom Wilson and Jerome McGinley. Tom Wilson, champion. Jerome McGinley.
Got a ring.
Never won the cup. So
he's got a ring, and you know, he was only 2 years away from UFA status. So I mean, you really want to get that
like
locked
I get when you win a cup or you win maybe multiple cups, and it's like, well, we got to lock up these guys because they're the best of the best. And yeah, the contract is going to be bad later. I always think of Brent Seabrook. I feel bad. We always call out Brent Seabrook when that the topic of conversation is that. And hey, even like TJ Oshie, I get that contract. Like, that's probably not going to look good in a while. But hey, you know what? You had to pick somebody to sign. You signed TJ Oshie, sure. Tom Wilson, like, I would say before last year, he was a liability. Like, he wasn't an asset. And last year, he found himself playing with one Hall of Famer. Evgeny Kuznetsov, still pretty young. You never know. But he's pretty good. He's pretty good at the whole hockey thing. And suddenly, He gets up to 14 goals. Now, the comparison that I kind of thought of was Alex Burrows, because he rode shotgun with the Sedins, who we'll get to later, by the way. And he put up some, you know, 20, 30 goal seasons. And so when it came time to pay him, you're like, well, it's pretty much Sedin driven, but he's got the numbers, so you give him what you have to give him. I mean, Tom Wilson scored 14 goals, man. Like, that's I'm not saying I could score 14 goals on that line, maybe like 6 or 7. Like, I don't have the wheels that I used to, but that's just seemingly it's not David Clarkson bad, but like, it's pretty bad. No. It's pretty bad.
It's not David Clarkson bad, because David Clarkson was like 28 when his deal was signed. But on the other hand, David Clarkson was also an unrestricted free agent, and he had a 30-goal season. Now, it was one 30-goal season, and anyone paying attention would have known that it was a mirage. But, yeah, this deal gets announced on, what was it, like Friday? Something, Thursday or Friday, the deal gets announced. And almost unanimously, the reaction is not just negative, but like outright mockery of this contract from the perspective of the Washington Capitals, with the exception of Caps fans who love Tom Wilson.
Oh yeah,
and many of them were what's the word I'm looking for? They were unhappy with the quality of the takes that they were reading. So let's try to frame the case. Let's do both sides here and let. The case for Tom Wilson is, I mean, to start with, this is a guy who's been in the league for 5 years, hasn't produced much. He was a first-round pick.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't like some no-talent guy that just kind of fought his way into the league. And, you know, he can play a little bit. He's pretty good for stretches last year, was pretty good in the playoffs. You know, I saw firsthand when they played the Leafs last year in the playoffs. You know, this is a useful player. Scored an overtime goal in that series. And, you know, was he playing with two superstars? Yeah. Same time. Coaches don't typically put bad players with superstars. I mean, you need to find a mix. And the argument would be that, you know, if a pretty good coach and Barry Trotz felt like this guy was the right guy to plug in on that line, then he must have some value. And of course, he's a player who you have to look at more than just the points. He's a physical guy. He's a throwback almost to a previous era where with the big hits, occasional fights, all of that stuff that still under the right circumstances can have some value. So, you know, you're paying for that as well. And the fact that you just won a cup and you're going to want to keep as much of the mix together. Now, again, Tom Wilson was an RFA. It wasn't like he was going anywhere. And it wasn't like, you know, it always kind of amuses me when these guys who are framed as heart and soul types are the ones that get top dollar, because you think if anyone was going to take the discount to keep the band together, it would be those guys. But, you know, I think everything I just said, the case that I just made, I can talk myself into like $4 million.
Right, 4 and 4, sure.
Yeah, but to go, you know, it's like I said last week and in previous weeks, that more and more with these contracts, the way that I'm kind of framing it in my mind is, what's the upside and what's the downside? And when you're talking, you got a 6-year contract. It's so hard to project what a 24-year-old is going to be like over the next 6 years of his career. It's hard enough to project for 6 months, let alone 6 years. So there's so many different ways this can go. But I'm sitting there going, okay, well, what's the downside? It doesn't take a lot of imagination to picture this deal being a disaster, right? To picture Tom Wilson settling in as being like a 10-12 goal scorer, a guy who maybe at some point gets bumped out of that spot. Maybe his production falls even more. Is he still physical? Yeah, maybe he's physical, but to what extent? How physical can he be? Is a guy who's already had suspension problems, has had some near misses, knowing how the Department of Player Safety operates, at some point, if he keeps throwing these questionable high hits, he might get the kind of Matt Cook, Rafi Torres treatment where they sit him down and go, look, you need to stop doing this or else next time we're just going to hammer you. And if that happens to Tom Wade, what kind of player is he then? You know, what kind of player is, as fighting becomes less and less of an aspect of this league? You know, it's, I have a very easy time imagining a scenario within a year or two where we look at Tom Wilson as a $2 or $3 million player and we're talking about this being one of the worst contracts in the league. Now, what's the upside? What's the best case? You know, the best case is probably what Tom Wilson continues to develop, continues to find that scoring touch. Maybe he's not a 7-goal scorer or a 14-goal scorer. Maybe he's a 20 or a 25-goal guy. Maybe 30 in a great year where everything goes well. If that happens, then he pretty much is an okay value at this contract. Like, that's it. The downside is disaster. The upside is it works out okay. I don't see the upside for the Capitals where this works out great. And that's right. That to me is the sign of a bad deal where your ceiling is just okay and your floor is a disaster. Because it, you look at the history of guys who play like Tom, with big physical guys, typically the ones who can score have shown you that by the time they're 24. There's not a lot of guys who, you know, certainly in the last 10 or 20 years who have developed along the kind of development path that he would need to take to live up to this contract. You mentioned Burroughs being one. The other guy, and this is going back a little ways, but maybe he's the guy that you look at if you're hoping this works out great for the Capitals, is a guy like Todd Bertuzzi, where he was not much of a scorer early in his career, and then it kind of clicked, and again, a case where he found a line where he was playing with talented guys, and it worked for at least a few years. But man, like I get why Caps fans love the guy. I you know, that's what fans are supposed to do. But I just don't see how this works out any better for Washington than just okay. And I can see a whole lot of ways it goes really, really bad.
You know what this contract also makes me think of? It makes me think of back maybe like 5-6 years ago when everybody was like, oh, but when the cap goes up, then it won't be so bad. And then the cap kind of stopped moving up a whole bunch. And suddenly, like, teams were stuck and they just had all these bad contracts and they weren't getting more space. And I feel like we're in that time now where everyone's just like, hey, cap's going to go up. And, you know, they're going to get more revenue once we add a 30-second team and all that. But I just...
Yeah. Like, I think flip side of that, though, is what's going to happen in the lockout in 2020? The cap might go down because they might shrink that revenue pie, and now suddenly 50-50 doesn't add up to the same sort of cap hit. So, you're right. That's you know, if I'm a Caps fan trying to talk myself into this, I'm saying Tom Wilson's 24. He's just started to really kind of show what he can do. In 2 or 3 years, he's going to be a better player. The cap will have gone up, so the hit's going to be lower. So you know, the arrow for Tom Wilson's pointing up, and the arrow for the cap hit's pointing down, and the deal's just going to get better as we go.
I just think
it's got to get a lot better.
What if he just has the same year he had last year again this year? What if he's just another 15-goal season? 15 goals, 38 points. Like, that's not a $5 million player.
Or what if a coach says, you know what, they've got a new coach. What if Todd Reardon says, I don't want this guy on my first line. I want somebody else there. Well, I'm going to put him on the third line and have him go out there and do Tom Wilson things and be a great third-line player. But you're paying so much. Like, in a way, it reminds me a little bit, only a little bit, but it's kind of like the Brent Seabrook deal in Chicago, where they had won 3 cups, and you're like, we got to keep the group together, got to keep the core, we got to reward them. And so they sign a contract that at the time everyone was like, ooh, that's not going to go well, and it hasn't gone well, and it looks like a terrible deal now. Tom Wilson is younger, so you know the fall off shouldn't be as strong. But it's the same kind of thinking, right? Like, in a way, and I know every cap, you know, there's not a Caps fan in the world who would trade anything for that championship. And, you know, they could be garbage for the next 5 years and they won't care because they've got the banner now. But it's in a way, it is kind of the curse of winning, is that now you feel like we got to keep this group together. And we got to pay whatever it takes to do it. And next thing you know, maybe it's a year or two later and you're like, our cap situation is completely screwed. because we made all these decisions with our hearts instead of our heads.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to work out, but what do I know? Since we're talking about elite wingers, why don't we just do Jerome McGinley now? Because I just, I'm really trying to figure out if there really are people who think he's borderline, or people who just say that. Because, I mean, like, I get it. He hasn't won a cup. Like, it's just too, but like, who cares, man? It's hard to win a cup. It's a team sport. 600 goals. You won a gold medal.
He's a leader. He's a winger.
He's a great.
And he can't, you know, went to a game seven of a Stanley Cup final. So what are, I mean.
Right. And he has like, you know, he's a tough guy. He fights. He's a great guy off the ice. Like, he has every single like thing. So like, I really don't think he's borderline. I just think that's like something that people got in their heads maybe like 3-4 years ago, and now they just kind of say it without anyone actually really believing that he's borderline. Because he's like, if Marty St. Louis is a Hall of Famer, like, how is Jerome McGinley not? You know.
And this is the thing, because this has been one of my pet peeves over the last few years, is that I find that whenever you mention the Hall of Fame with hockey fans, one of two things happens. If you talk about the Hall of Fame in general, fans complain that it's too easy to get in. It's the Hall of Very Good.
Sure.
It's not just for the elite guys. It's they let too many guys in. But if you mention any specific player, that guy has to be a Hall of Famer. Like, if you're like, okay, well, so Marian Hossa, they're like, well, anyone who doesn't think Marian Hossa is a Hall of Famer doesn't know what they're talking about. And you go, okay, Daniel Alfredson. Anybody who thinks Daniel Alfredson isn't going to the Hall of Fame deserves to be punched in the mouth. What about the Sedins? Anyone who doesn't think the Sedins, and you're just like going down the, anyone who doesn't think Henrik Zetterberg is a Hall of Fame, you're like, he's got 900 points. Are we sure he's a sure thing? And they're like, if you don't think, I'm going to come to your house and I'm going to hit your children over the head with a frying pan until you admit that Henrik Zetterberg is a first ballot sure thing Hall of Famer. And you're kind of sitting there going, well, this is how we get the Hall of Very Good, because every individual player, nobody wants to ever take the contrarian stance. But with Jerome McGinley, there is no contrarian stance.
Right.
The guy, he scored 600 goals as a power forward, didn't win an MVP, but was, you know, certainly it probably should have won one. Took a not very good team to within one goal of winning the Stanley Cup. Probably they would have won a Stanley Cup if a replay judge had been paying attention. Gold medals. I mean, I can't imagine the argument that Jerome McGinley isn't first ballot. Like, you know, forget first ballot. This is one of those things where when the committee goes into the room, the conversation lasts 5 minutes. And then you move on to whoever else you need to argue about. So I'm kind of with you. I have seen these like takes saying anyone who doesn't think, who is that?
Right.
Like, show me somebody that's not like just random guy on Twitter with 7 followers. But I'm not seeing it, because you're right. If Martin St. Louis is in and Daniel Alfredson is going to be in and the Sedins are sure things, we're not even having a conversation about Jerome McGinley.
The only thing that I think should keep him out of the Hall of Fame is that he chose to go to Colorado instead of Tampa after he left Calgary / Boston, I guess, that year. He had a chance to go to Tampa, and he said, you know what? I want to go play for Patrick Waugh.
Can we briefly just talk about what Jerome McGinley's Hall of Fame plaque is going to look like?
What's it going to look like?
The dude's got 14 middle names. Have you ever seen Jerome McGinley's full name?
Oh, yeah. I can't recite everything by memory.
No, but neither can I. But I think, like, I literally think Elvis is in there as one of the middle names. If they go full name on that thing.
Oh, they have to.
Right. Yeah, you're going to get there and be like, why is one of the plaques like 3 times the size of everyone else's? That must be Gretzky or Gordie Howe. Nope. Jerome McGinley's name. No, he's... and you know, the great thing about McGinley is... He's almost a boring topic for this kind of conversation, because he was so good and everybody liked him. And, like, you know, there's just, like, there's not even a really good butt on his... on his career. This guy scored 600 goals, and I think a lot of people, if you ask them, like, what's your number one Jerome McGinley memory, would not mention a goal.
Right.
They would mention maybe the shift against the Lightning where they scored the overtime winner in game 5, the fight against Vinny LeCavalier.
Mm-hmm.
like iconic moment, but one of the probably most memorable fights of the last 25 years. The assist on the golden goal in the Olympics.
Who cares about that?
Do you remember that one, Dave? I don't want to confuse you, because I'm talking that this is the 2010 gold medal, not the 2002 gold medal. Uh-huh. That was the one where he scored on the Mario Lemieux between the legs. I just want to make sure you're not confused about Canada's gold medal victories over the...
Sure.
Anyways.
Sure.
Have you ever met anyone who didn't like Jerome McGinley?
No. Dude, I remember I went to cover the outdoor game in Calgary when they played Montreal. I forget what year it was. It was like 2011 or 2012. And it was kind of like my first sort of like solo travel somewhere by yourself assignment. Like, I was in Calgary forever. I was there for like the rink build out and everything. And there was like nothing to do there. Like, there was no, like, Calgary was on the road. Like, the Hitmen were on the road. There was like no hockey teams in town. So like for like 4 or 5 days, like, I just kind of just talked to like Dan Craig about making ice. Like, it was just, and I felt like I was always bothering him too. Like, hey Dan, can I just get you for like five minutes just to talk about, and he's like, well, we're spraying water down now. And so it was one of those.
Building ice right now, Dave.
And then eventually the Flames come back to town, and obviously he's the star of the team. He's the captain. And he wasn't in the locker room right away after like the practice or whatever it was that went on at the arena. And so to kill time, like, I was just kind of like talking to some other guys in the room, and I turn around and I realize like Jerome McGinley's been in the room for like 10 minutes and I missed like the beginning of Jerome McGinley. I was like, oh no. And he was like in a corner. So it was hard for me to kind of even like position myself in a way to like hear him or like get like him on the recorder. And so like he probably talked for like 20 minutes. And then like I sort of like slowly kept filtering my way closer as people left. And I know I asked him questions he had already answered like 18 minutes earlier, but like he just gave me like thoughtful, nice. He wasn't rushed. He wasn't like, he was probably annoyed to have to ask the questions or answer the questions again. But like, he was just like, people throw the term gentleman around maybe a little too freely, but like, I would describe Jerome McGinley as a gentleman. Maybe not when he's punching Vinny LeCavalier in the face, but I'm sure that was gentlemanly.
Even then, yeah. He did that in a gentlemanly way.
That was a gentlemanly thing.
To me, the top testament to Jerome McGinley is this guy. Yeah, he played for a bunch of other teams at the end of his career, but he's Calgary Flame through and through.
Mm-hmm.
And a power forward, hits, fights, everything. The first guy in when things went ugly, he was the first guy in leading the charge for the Calgary Flames for decade plus. And I don't know any Oiler fans who don't like the guy.
Really?
Like, I'm sure there were like moments where you're like, okay, that after last night's game, today I hate Jerome McGinley. But then the next day you're like, nah, I don't.
Yeah,
like, that is, to have that respect is, I mean, in, I feel like there should be some sort of contrarian take here, but there just isn't for Jerome McGinley. Like, that, it would have been great to see him win the cup. Would have been great to see him maybe land in some better situations towards the end of his career. But, you know, it's a 31 team league. You know, we got to get our heads around the fact that some really good players are not going to win championships in this league for no reason other than there's just 31 teams fighting for it. And we've got to get our heads around the fact that that's okay, because the alternative is the NHL turns into the NBA, where anyone who doesn't have a ring by a certain point has to just go and sign with the team that's already the best, and we all kind of roll our eyes. But what do you expect? If you have to have a ring or else you've failed as a player, no, that's nonsense. Of course you have.
Although, I don't know, you just kind of sold me maybe on the idea of getting super teams in the NHL.
Maybe
this is how we do it. Super teams are, I mean, I get why they're not. Like, I, as a person who just likes hockey, doesn't like a specific team, like, I can understand where if you're like a fan of the Raptors and, you know, you're just like, we got a really good team, we won the East, and you're looking over at the West and you're just like, oh man, we're not going to do anything if we get there. Like, I can see how that saps the life out of you. But like, as someone who just, you know, just, I just enjoy watching good teams and good players.
But you're in the minority, right? Like, most fans are fans of a team first.
Right, right. Oh, I get it. I totally get it.
But I would like, I think the NHL version of a super team would be great, because they wouldn't be the Golden State Warriors. They'd still be very beatable.
Right.
They'd still be less, more likely than not to not win the Stanley Cup. So you know, I love the idea of the Predators or the Lightning loading up and then let's see who knocks them off, or maybe somebody doesn't. But
like, think about back in the day when like the Red Wings would win the President's Trophy in the pre-salary cap era, they lose in like the first round or the second round, or they wouldn't get to the Stanley Cup final because some team would just find a way to win 4 out of 7. Like,
it was an upset, and yeah. It was an upset that meant something, not like today where you're like, oh, the number 4 seed beat the number 1 seed. It's like, yeah, they were 4 points apart in the standings. And
right, or even back in the day, like when it was the setup we have now, where like, you know, there would be the 1 versus 4, 2 versus 3 thing, and like the team that had like 61 points and finished 4th in the Patrick Division would upset the team that had like 105. Like, that was,
yep.
I'm pretty sure that probably happened once or twice. Maybe that never happened, but like that was just.
Well, it did. Like Minnesota North Stars going to the 91 final.
They played the Penguins, right. Yeah. So
yeah,
it's that's why like I'd love to get rid of the salary cap and just let everybody just kind of do whatever they wanted, because you would get more teams like that and you get more upsets like that. And there's not the Golden State Warriors like inevitability feeling most of the time with those teams. So yada, yada, yada. Nobody thinks Jerome Iginla isn't a first ballot Hall of Famer, and just want to make that clear that he's totally a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Yeah. If you find somebody who actually sincerely holds that take, please bring them to my attention, because I would love to see what that argument looks like.
Someone's going to write that.
The only way you could make the argument is if your warped version of a Hall of Fame is like Gretzky, Lemieux, Howe, Bobby Orr, and like 3 other guys, and that's it. And you've been against every other Hall of Famer, you know, for the last few years.
Nick Lidstrom, no way. He's not as good as Bobby Orr.
Exactly. Okay. Like, that take is, that's a bad take, to be clear, but at least it would be like a consistent take. There's no, you know, everybody who's scored more goals than Jerome Iginla is in the Hall of Fame, except Jaromír Jagr. Everyone who had more points is in the Hall of Fame, except Jagr, and I think Pierre Turgeon. But Pierre Turgeon, the much different era, and Pierre Turgeon didn't do anything but score. So it's not even a comparison.
And Pierre Turgeon played in the 80s, too. That was, he had a different sort of league.
Yeah, he played of the 80s. He played... Pierre Turgeon had one of those weird careers that went on way longer than people remember. But if you adjust for error, I'm sure Iginla's numbers get even crazier. Like I normally kind of roll my eyes a little bit at the whole thing about whether someone's a first ballot Hall of Famer. Say, you know, if you're in, you're in. It's ultimately doesn't matter. Jerome Iginla should be first ballot, 5-minute conversation, and you know, let's just move on to whoever else they're going to have to actually argue about, because there's no argument against it.
All right. Well, we're at the halfway point, so feels like a break time. Feels like we should recharge, reassess, reboot. I don't know. I can't. It's kind of early. I haven't had coffee this morning. And we'll be back. We've got some more stuff, right? We have Ottawa Senators stuff, of course. We wouldn't have a season finale without Ottawa Senators stuff. And I'm sure we'll get to some questions, Sedin stuff, and stick around. We'll be right back.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We're back. It's the back half of the season finale of Biscuits, Colon, a Hockey Podcast. And before we get to all the Ottawa Senators news that you guys love to tune into, Trevor Linden and the Vancouver Canucks parted ways. Nobody quit. Nobody was fired. They just sort of drifted apart the way the mass continent of, what's it called again? Before we had 7 continents, there's some word for that. Whatever that word was, they've drifted apart, and it was all very weird how they did it.
So if Jerome Iginla is looking for something to do, other than the goals and fights, everyone's favorite memory of Jerome Iginla was when he made the Flames hang around on the ice to go shake hands with Trevor Linden after his last game as a Canuck. Maybe get another. We need another handshake line, Jerome, because Trevor Linden has once again, for the third time, parted ways with the Canucks. And yeah, this is it. It has been presented as a mutual parting of the ways, but I don't know that anyone is buying that.
But who do you think, like, if you had to bet, was it like the ownership that was like, get the hell out of here? Or was Trevor Linden like, yeah, I hate this. I don't want to do this anymore. Like, I feel like it's the second thing.
Yeah. The piecing together the various stories that have come out and the kind of read between the lines thing, and I'm not acting like I have any sort of inside information here, but just kind of reading between the lines on what other people are saying, it certainly sounds like what happened was there was a difference in philosophy in terms of where are the Canucks in their rebuild, how close are they to contending again, and what should the strategy be in the short term to get there, and that ownership wanted to hear that they were close and that the playoffs is a reasonable goal and that the pain part of the rebuild was over and it was that they had enough pieces to move forward, and that Trevor Linden didn't buy that. And Trevor Linden felt like there was still more work to be done, and that Jim Benning either did buy that or realized that who signed his paychecks and which side he should be on, and that Jim Benning basically went to ownership and said, yeah, we can be a playoff team. That's why we go out and get Jay Beagle and guys like that. and that Trevor Linden either at that point said, I don't agree with this, and I'm not going to put my name on something where I don't think we're going in the right direction. Or maybe there was a power struggle, or maybe ownership started looking differently at Trevor Linden because he wasn't telling them what they wanted to hear and what they felt was the situation. But yeah, Trevor Linden has not, as far as I'm aware, spoken to anyone about this yet. Like in terms of the media, he had a statement that was put out by the team, which was very basic and short and didn't mention anyone by name, didn't thank anyone or anything like that. So the assumption is he was either pushed out or quit on his own. And, in some sense, okay, maybe that's mutually agreeing to part ways, right? Where you go, I hate it here. Yeah, well, we hate having you here, and let's mutually agree that don't let the door hit you on the way out. But there's more to this story than just Trevor Linden wanted to go spend time with his family and play more golf and handed the keys to the kingdom over to Jim Benning.
It always seemed like a job that maybe he didn't love, but like, I don't know. I just kind of based that on just watching like Canucks results, and like, he's just kind of more just like a popular player from back in the day when the Canucks were struggling. You can be like, hey, look, it's Trevor Linden in a suit in the press box. He's part of the organization. Remember right. How much we loved the Canucks back then?
And you put him, when things go bad, he's the guy you put in.
Yeah.
In front of the media, in front of the cameras, and how mad can you remember this guy? You've got his poster hanging in your childhood bedroom. You can't be that mad at us.
And like, I can get the argument too that like the Canucks could be a playoff team next year because the Pacific isn't great. You never know.
Anybody can be a playoff team next year.
Right, exactly. The Vancouver Canucks, the Vegas Golden Knights, were a Stanley Cup final team. Therefore, anything could happen. We should stop predicting based on that from now on. Just never again. Who do you like to make the playoffs? I don't know. I really don't know. I have no idea. Just pick like a couple teams. No, no, I don't want to. I've learned my lesson. Never again.
I can't wait to read your season preview next year. Just shrug emoji.
Here's my preseason power rankings. Tied for first. Every single team. Everyone's got a shot. That's my new thing now. Just no real strong opinions. Anyone could do anything at any time. You never know. Follow me on Twitter. Thanks for reading.
So, it's going to be fascinating to see where this goes next, because the Canucks have kind of, in a sense here, lost a bit of a safety net. Jim Benning, there is, I don't think there's a perception, but there's at least this, there seems to be a segment of the fan base and a segment of just the hockey world that sees this as maybe Jim Benning winning a power struggle or outmaneuvering Trevor Linden, which doesn't speak well for Trevor Linden, but and you wonder if the pressure is going to get cranked up now if the Canucks are what they are most likely to be next year, which is a team that is not particularly close to the playoffs, even with all their expensive fourth liners and all the rest of this. Because, I mean, I don't... The Canucks do have decent prospects on the way.
Yeah.
You know, that much is true. You know, they're probably maybe one of the best prospect groups in the league even at this point. The flip side of that is that's what's supposed to happen when you're drafting in the top five year after year. So, you know, you don't get, you get, yeah, I mean, good for you, that, but that's kind of what you were supposed to do. So, I don't think it's, and a lot of those guys aren't necessarily guys that are going to jump in the lineup next year and immediately contribute. So, I don't know. I don't know if you take the young guys, they have the Bo Horvat, Brock Besser, you take the prospects who are on their way. Even if they all hit their most likely upsides, I still don't know if that you've got the core of a contending team built there. So if the argument was the way, or if the dispute was went down the way it's been hinted at, I'm on Team Linden here. I think that the Canucks, you know, but if the owners want those playoff gates, and I mean, I guess the flip side is if you're Jim Benning's, and the owners want the playoffs, what are you going to do? You've been the GM for 4 years now. It's not like you can go in and go, no, man, we stink. This roster's terrible. We can't come close to the playoffs. You got to go for it, and you just kind of close your eyes and hope you're one of those teams that can kind of, I don't want to say fluke your way in, but has a better than expected season. Get in with 96 points and cross your fingers and hope that buys you another couple years.
The bottom line is that when you sign Jay Beagle, you raise expectations. You know, you can't avoid it. You bring in a guy like Jay Beagle, and fans can't settle for anything less than a Stanley Cup. So
that's right.
You know, you.
But the players will see that. You know, when they walk into the dressing room and they look over and there's Jay Beagle, you're going, wow, okay, the bar's been raised. call the guy, say, hey. Cancel the, I know I said June wedding. No, we're not. It's got to be July. I'm going to be busy in June.
Putting it off.
Yeah, we got Jay.
No more starting a family in May, because we're going to be busy in May winning the conference championship. Sorry. Job comes first. Oh, I love July news. It's the best.
I can't wait to hear from Canucks fans next May when they're in the conference final.
Well, that's the thing, yeah, but like if you're in the Pacific, you only have to win two rounds against two teams that probably aren't great, so yeah, that one could probably come back to
that
bite
is
us.
The one thing I'll say, like when it's the Canucks or anyone else, when people are like, there's no way they're making the playoffs, and it's like, were you not paying attention last year? Like, just, it's unlikely they make the playoff. That's all you can say about anything in the NHL. It's likely or it's unlikely. That's it. That's as far as we'll go. It's likely that the Tampa Bay Lightning will be good and that the Vancouver Canucks will be bad.
Right. Meanwhile, 2 years ago, the Lightning missed the playoffs. They were supposed to win the cup that year. And just one guy gets hurt, and it's a whole new ball game, my friend. Or puck game. It's not really a ball game in hockey, I guess.
Speaking of bad teams, bad Canadian teams, which is kind of our bread and butter.
Yeah.
I don't think we have a ton we can do on this, but your reaction to Cody Ceci, whose arbitration hearing is tomorrow, I think, he has asked for $6 million.
Sure.
A year.
Sure.
$6 million defenseman, Cody Ceci.
And the Canucks want to give him 3.1, I believe, is their end of it?
The Senators want to give him 3, but the Canucks probably also want to give him 3.1 because I could see Jim Benning just wandering into another team's arbitration.
Oh, did I say Canucks?
All confused and just being like, 3.1, and they're like, Jim, that's, no, you can't. And he's like, 3.6, and they're like, Jim, no, this is not This is not how it works. But yeah, Cody Ceci, the stud defenseman. I know if you're a fan of another team and you're like, who, I've never even heard of him. The stud defenseman that the Senators have refused to trade for any number of star players. It was rumored to be on the table for Jonathan Drouin. They would not do that. Was even rumored, there was at one point a rumor that he may have come up in a Taylor Hall discussion. But no, they have held on to him because you got to keep your core pieces. And he played a ton of minutes last year.
Played a lot.
That's it. I just gave you Cody Ceci's side of the arbitration hearing.
Played
That's,
a lot of hockey. I love like I
played
like,
a lot of minutes.
I'm trying to imagine how he came to the $6 million number. Like, it made me think of the scene in Coming to America when they're out of money. So Arsenio Hall goes to like the wire place and he's just like, you know, how about $500,000? And the woman behind the counter is like, why don't you make it a cool mill? Like, I'm just picturing like his agent being like, don't ask for four. Just make it a cool six. You may as well ask for six. Who cares?
This is what we get in a world where arbitration, they always just split the number down the middle. Just go insane then. Give a super high number and 11. You're going to end up. So this will be a good test of that is whether, because, you know, I would argue that the Senators coming in at 3.5, something like that, that was about right. Like, you know, the number here should probably be maybe start with a 4, but not, you know, not a high number after that. So it's going to be fascinating to see whether the arbitrator actually does that or whether he just does the same split the difference deal and comes in at 4.8 and we all kind of roll our eyes. But that'll be interesting if they even get to the hearing. And then the other two hearings that are coming up this week that are interesting to me, at least. I think there's more than that. There's like a half dozen left. But we've got Mark Stone on Friday and then William Karlsson on Saturday. And we don't know the numbers on them yet because that typically comes out the day before or a couple of days before. But where do you think those numbers come in and where do you think the final comes in if we get an arbitrator's decision?
Well, William Karlsson's so hard because he was I won't say literally nobody heard of him before last year, but he was just, he was an afterthought. Like, he's just some guy who couldn't play for the Jackets, and now he's a 40-goal guy. If I was William Karlsson and I was submitting my number, I would probably submit... I'd probably go Cody Ceci level. I'd probably say, hey, I'm a Cody Ceci level player. I think 6 is fair. And then maybe...
I'd go much higher than that if I was William Karlsson. I'd go 7 or 8. I mean, you're a 43-goal scorer. You can sit there and say I was one of the 5 top goal scorers in the league. And what's interesting about Karlsson is normally my feeling on arbitration is why would you ever go? Why would you ever go through that? Get together, put your heads together, get a deal done, preferably a longer-term one that makes both sides happy. But I could see this being a case where the Golden Knights don't actually mind if he gets a big number for the short term because they've got lots of cap space.
Yeah.
So, but what you don't want to do, I don't think, if you're George McPhee, is make a big long-term bet on William Karlsson at a high number because we don't know. He went from... being an afterthought to a 40-goal guy. Maybe he is a 40-goal guy. Maybe he's somewhere in between. Who knows? I don't, you know, I think you're happy to spend a year to do a 1 or 2 year deal and find out, even if it's a high number, find out for sure what you've got here and then go from there. So it actually wouldn't shock me. That's a case where I could see the Knights coming in at maybe a higher number than you might think and not playing hardball, and B, if they go to a hearing, having the hearing maybe not be as contentious as it typically would be because the Knights just want to get through it, get a decision. They can say they tried. They can say, hey, you know, this is the number the arbitrator gave us. And then if he's 43-goal William Karlsson again, go ahead and sign a longer-term deal at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Mark Stone is kind of the exact opposite in that it suggests that, you know, and again, that's one where I'm not convinced Mark Stone wants a long-term deal with the Senators, so he might have to do arbitration just to get that 1-year deal to get him to UFA. And that's going to be very interesting, is how high a number does he come in at? And how low do the Senators come in, knowing that obviously that, you know, they don't have the money to spend. And yet, I don't know, I wonder if there's some psychology here where if you're Ottawa, you're going, man, everyone already thinks we're the cheapskates. We've already ticked off half our roster by playing hardball on every contract. You know, is there any chance here that maybe you don't go for the absolute rock bottom number? Because I think Mark Stone's going to come in with a real high number.
Like, Mark Stone should just come in with like $11 million. Just be like, 11, that's my number.
Yeah. Just, and sends I want like, $100 million. Let's go halfway.
Just yes.
It wouldn't shock me to see Mark Stone come in a bit with a ask of like $8 million. Why not? You're one of the better two-way wingers in the game. And then, you know, especially if you don't want to be in Ottawa long term anyways, put the number out, put that flag in the ground, plant that as you know, a high number, if only because you're anchoring for the next time around. If I'm Mark Stone, I'm going high, and then let's see how much the Senators lowball if they do, and go from there. Just try to get my money for 1 year, and then either get me out of here, or if the situation has gotten better, now I feel better about committing to a longer term situation.
It's amazing. No one's come in. No one's swept in and said, "Hey, you wanna get out of here? I got a thing called an offer sheet. You interested?"
They had the opportunity. They can't do it now.
Yeah.
Now that he's got arbitration, but the opportunity was there. And I mean, you would have thought that would have been
like somebody, anybody.
I mean, yeah, a team with no money and a player who wants out. You would think now. The flip side of that is maybe Mark Stone was like, I'm not signing any offer sheets because I'm not, or at least not anything long term, because the Senators might match and then I'm stuck here. But you would have thought somebody could have come in with a 1 year deal, said, let us get you out of there, and then we'll do an extension in January. But apparently not. NHL GMs just don't see any need to use the one and only tool they have for acquiring young in their prime players in a league that is dominated by young in their prime players.
Restricted free agency. What does that even mean anyway? You're free, but you're restricted. Like, who came up with that term to describe players that are, you know, coming off their ELCs? Restricted free agent. Are you free? Yeah. Can you go wherever you want? No. I'm actually restricted. Oh, God. I cannot wait for the next lockout, man.
That's it. You know, it was totally a married person who came up with that term. Hey man, are you free on Friday? Yes. Yeah, well, we're going here. Oh no, I can't do that. I am a restricted free agent. All right. Reader mail?
I think it might be time for some reader mail. Sponsored by nobody. Just wanted to see how that sounded. Reader mail sponsored by somebody. So we got a question from Snepstis's Mustache. That's a Twitter account. Should power play stats be kept as a ratio of time on power play to goal scored and not a percentage?
I've thought about this.
Because, like, because you know, you have a 25-second power play that gets cut short by a penalty, like, you're 0 for 1, but really, like, you're 0 for, like, 0.25 because you didn't get the full 2 minutes. Yeah.
Or the other way to do it would be, and this wouldn't necessarily work as well on a game, like, per game basis, but over the season, is just how much power play time does it take for a team to score a goal? Basically, what is, you know, this team scores every 8 minutes on the power play. This team scores every 9 minutes, you know, something like that. Because it feels like, you know, scoring 10 seconds into a power play versus scoring a minute 50 in, seems like the first tells you something different about the effectiveness of your power play. So I've wondered if over the course of a season, if there was a better way to do it than just giving a flat percentage that may or may not tell you all that much. But yeah, I don't mind that idea.
Yeah, I think that would tell you more, but I think that would also probably be, like, TV broadcasts still use plus minus. So,
yeah,
you know, having them figure that. I mean, some broadcasts don't even show you shot totals. Like, you're watching a game on
plus minus.
Yeah, like plus minus, like 0-0.
My favorite is when you get the combined plus minus for a line. Yeah. They're a combined minus six tonight. What? What?
The Marchand, Bergeron, and Pasternak.
It's 2-0. How are they minus six? That's like, yeah. How long did it take you three guys to get to the game tonight? Well, we were a combined 45 minutes in the cab, so it took you 15 minutes to get here? Yes, that's right. We just add all our numbers up.
Okay. Corey wants to know, will James Neal or David Perron or anyone else that leaves the team to sign elsewhere get a video tribute from Vegas when they return this year? The one-year video tribute. I feel like yes, because...
Yeah. It's the entire history of your franchise.
Yeah, they played 100% of seasons for the
Plus,
Vegas
you know,
Golden
like,
Knights.
It's Vegas. I can't wait to see Vegas tribute videos because they're not going to be like the treacly little emotional, I will remember you. Like, it's got to be, you got to have the Knight come out and, like, I don't know, behead somebody dressed as, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, maybe they'll go the other way and have the Knight, like, you know, do something to like James Neal and effigy or something, you know, just how dare you leave us.
What did they do in like ancient to like throw his body on a fiery pit or something like that? He probably wouldn't really
like drawn and quartered or something, like put his head on a spike or a pike.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's what you do. Just, yeah. Instead of retiring numbers, just heads on spikes in the rafters. I think we're onto something. Call us Vegas.
You caught me mid ginger ale sip.
Yeah,
there.
as Dave chokes to death.
It's a good way to wrap it up. Bang bang Bart. What's more responsible for the dead puck era? Coaching, the trap, that sort of thing, or better goaltending? What if anything could be done about the former?
Good question.
I think it was. Truthfully, it was Jacques Lemaire and the Devils, man. Like, they were this team that couldn't score with anybody, so they just said, hey, we'll clog up the middle. There was no two-line pass back then, so you couldn't really do anything to get through it, and they had enough talent to counterpunch, and as what happens in every sport, you know, teams see a thing that works. And you know what's funny is, like, in every sport, I've seen arguments about the shift in baseball, should they get rid of it? Like, I'm a huge fan of getting rid of it. Like, I'm totally on board with doing whatever you can to help your team win no matter what. And if, you know, the analytics tell you that, you know, you should have three guys on this side of second base, three guys on that side of second base, I get it. But, like, in terms of sports, we kind of forget that it's entertainment and that watching a dude hit a ground error to, like, deep second or short right and ground out isn't fun. Like, a guy roping a single to right is fun. So maybe you should take that into consideration with hockey. It's the same thing. Like, no matter what happens, like, the coaching always finds a way to stretch. Like, there's no coaching that ever shows up and is like, hey, here's a way to score five more runs or three more goals per game. It's always strangling
Except
the life.
Except in football. In football, for some reason, you do see that show up. You know, like, the Wildcat will show up for a little while or
stinks.
The, you know. But yeah, like, and that's why, you know, I love the NFL where it's like, this guy's an offensive coach. This guy's a defensive coach. And there we don't have that. I wrote a thing about the baseball shift just in the fact that it feels so much, what's happening in baseball now feels so much like what happened in hockey in the mid-90s, except that in baseball, they're having the conversation.
Right.
They're having the debate right now about what should we do. And players have given suggestions. And, you know, some people want big changes, some people don't want to change anything, but they're having the conversation. And it's like, can you even imagine a world where this was happening in baseball and baseball's response was to just do nothing for 20 plus years.
Just pretend it's not happening.
And just be like, and then every year be like, maybe we'll do something. And then they're like, how about we make the gloves a quarter inch smaller? And then they're like, oh, that changed nothing. Okay, why don't we make the bases half an inch bigger? Oh, that didn't do anything at all. Like, it's laughable to think that they would not do what they're doing now, which is see what's happening and go, we got to figure this out right now because it's impacting the quality of the game. And yet that's of course what the NHL did for the ongoing dead puck era, where to this day they still haven't really addressed it. To answer the question, I think there's an overlap between coaching and goaltending, because the goaltending is so much better now, but it's not like goaltenders themselves have just gotten, you know, better reflexes or better, you know, they're better coached. Their goaltenders now know exactly where to be, exactly how to be positioned on every single shot, exactly how, you know, head tracking and everything else. So coaching has bled into everything. But I do think it's coaching. I think if you take the best goalies today with their giant equipment, drop them in the mid-80s, they would dominate. They would be the best goaltenders in the league by a mile, but they'd still get scored on because you'd have the chaos of what hockey is supposed to be with mistakes and creativity and all that other stuff versus taking somebody, you know, a bad goalie, throwing them into today's game with all the shot blocking and, you know, this and that, and everyone knows exactly their defensive milestones and where they have to be. It's the coaching. The goaltending is a big part of it, but it's coaching that ruined hockey.
And finally, last question of the season. Daniela, what do you think the Islanders' 2018-19 record will be, seeing as they're coming off an 80-point season with Tavares as their number one center, getting 84 points with a minus 12? Oh, Daniela drops plus minus on us right after we disparage plus minus. I'm so snake bitten after Vegas that I don't know how to predict anything anymore. You can probably argue I don't know how to predict anything before that. 71 points.
It is likely that the Islanders will miss the playoffs.
Yes.
No, I mean, they should be worse. They clearly should be worse than they were last year. I don't know. There's the uncertainty of just what the NHL is, and there is also that piece of me that's like, you know, sometimes a star player leaves and everyone else just kind of rallies around, like, you know what, screw this. Nobody thinks we're going to be any good. Let's go out there. And I could see them getting a good start and just getting some momentum rolling, and, you know, if the goaltending is finally better. But, I'm going to go high. I'll say...
Ooh, higher than 71.
75 points. That's not actually... I mean, that 4 points, that's 4 shootout wins better, but...
I feel like we're playing Card Sharks. Remember that game show?
That was a great show.
We asked 100 housewives, how often does your husband fart? Well, I think husbands fart a lot, so I'm going to say 81. I'm going to say it's much lower, Bob, because I think husbands hold it in. And then the answer is 82. And it was just, and then you get to go higher or lower. That was a good.
I should have priced this right at you and just gone.
You should have gotten a dollar. You should have gotten 1 point on the Islanders. I think that was probably the way to go.
1 point, as long as I'm not going over. Yeah, that could be. Well, 1 point, but I'll tell you what, man. Then, you know, Lou Lamoriello was winning that draft lottery, so. Brighter days ahead, Islander fans.
Well, that's it. We're done. We're wrapping it up for the season here. We thank everybody for listening. We love you very much. We thank you for reading as well. We're sorry that we couldn't give you an Erik Karlsson trade episode in the month of July. We really thought that was going to be a lock. We had 5 Tuesdays in July to work out an episode time for a trade, and it never happened. One other question there. You want to predict next year's Stanley Cup final right now? What do you think it's going to be?
Right now?
Yeah, I lost the name of the person who asked the question, but next year, 2019 Stanley Cup final is
Tampa Bay Lightning.
Going chalk. Okay.
This pause is me desperately trying to think of somebody to say other than the Predators, because I feel like that's the most. You know what? Screw it. Tampa, Winnipeg.
See, I'm going to go Columbus, Winnipeg. How about that?
Wow.
Columbus, Winnipeg. The battle of the cities that players apparently want to escape from, where Jacob Trouba wants to leave. Maybe Jacob Trouba will be traded for Artemi Panarin before the season, and then they'll meet in the final.
I like it. Book it.
So there you go. Pre-order Sean's book, and then reorder it, and then order it again. I got nothing to sell, so I'm not going to sell anything. You wanna say goodbye to the people?
Yeah, just thanks everyone. This season was a lot of fun. It's been two real good years. Thanks to everyone who listened, rated, shared, all the other stuff. It has been great, and hopefully we will talk to you next year.
Yeah, and real quick on the Sedins.
Yes, we spent teasing this, so we have to go out with right. The Sedins.
So here you go. Here's our 20-minute interview with Henrik and Daniel Sedin. Thanks, everybody.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.